besieged Gaza Strip for the 14th day in a row, leaving a trail of death and destruction in the blockaded territory. At least 20 Palestinians have been killed in the latest Israeli airstrikes that hit residential buildings in Khan Yunis. That's in the south of the Gaza Strip. Dozens more were injured there. And over to central Gaza, Israeli attacks killed several people in the city of Deir al-Balah. The death toll from the two-week aggression is now around 4,000. The aerial attacks, coupled with the total blockade by Israel, has worsened the humanitarian situation as well. Food and water supplies are running out, while hospitals are under immense strain. The UN chief has voiced concern over the situation in Gaza.
Both of my humanitarian appeals are essential in and of themselves. And to help realize these two appeals, I am calling for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire. For nearly 2 weeks, the people of Gaza have gone without any shipments of fuel, food, water, medicine, and other essentials. Civilians in Gaza desperately need core services and supplies, and for that we need rapid and unimpeded humanitarian access. We need food, water, medicine, and fuel now. We need it at scale, and we need it to be sustained.
Guterres was speaking in a press conference in the Egyptian capital, Cairo. Israel has cut off supply of electricity, water, fuel, and medicines to Gaza, home to 2.3 people. In the meantime, Egyptian media say the Rafah crossing between Gaza and Egypt will be opened on Friday to send relief aid into the territory. The World Health Organization has also called for a daily aid flow, including fuel, into Gaza.
Fuel is also needed for hospital generators, ambulances, and desalination plants, and we urge Israel to add fuel to the life-saving supplies allowed to enter Gaza. Our trucks are loaded and ready to go. We're working with Egypt and Palestine Red Crescent societies to deliver our supplies into Gaza as soon as the Rafah crossing is opened.
But one of the most critical items which need to be added to that convoy is fuel. Fuel to make sure these desalination plants can run. Fuel to make sure these bakeries can run. Fuel to make sure that UN partners can actually implement the most essential operations. And fuel to ensure these hospitals can sustain their operations and can sustain lives. So fuel is absolutely a top priority.
Hamas has fired a barrage of rockets toward Israel's positions as it presses ahead with its retaliation for Israel's relentless bombardment of the fully besieged Gaza Strip. The Qassam Brigades, the armed wing of Hamas, say they've targeted Tel Aviv in response to the regime's war crimes against Palestinians. The resistance group also fired missiles at Ascalon in southern Israel earlier today. At least two missiles have reportedly hit Sderot. Sirens also sounded in the northern city of Nahariya for the first time. Meantime, Al-Quds Brigades, the military wing of the Islamic Jihad resistance movement, say they have struck an Israeli settlement in the occupied territories. According to Tel Aviv, over 1,400 Israelis have been killed in attacks by the resistance front since October the 7th. Some 4,500 others have also been wounded. The head of the political bureau of the Hamas resistance movement says Israel's crimes against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have revealed the regime's Nazi and fascist nature. In his televised speech, Ismail Haniyeh warned that the ongoing Israeli aggression on Gaza could turn into a regional war if the regime's brutal attacks continue. Haniyeh stressed that the way out of the current situation is an end to the Israeli occupation and freedom of the Palestinian people. The senior Hamas official said the world should condemn Israel's crimes and hold their perpetrators accountable at international courts. Haniyeh also said the U.S. administration failed to muster international and regional support for the Israeli aggression and make Arab countries accept displacement of Palestinians in Gaza. He called on Muslim nations to hold elections on Friday to demand a halt to the Israeli aggression. He also called for more efforts to deliver aid to the people in Gaza, adding that the besieged territory is facing a humanitarian catastrophe due to Israel's Nazi-style brutality. Well, this just in, an Israeli air raid has destroyed the historical Al-Omari Mosque in northern Gaza Strip. This is in continuation of the indiscriminate attacks being carried out by the Israeli regime against the besieged Gaza Strip. The Israeli regime is also cracking down on Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, where troops have raided the Nur Shams refugee camp. At least 13 Palestinians were killed in the raid on the camp in the city of Tulkarm. That's according to the Palestinian Health Ministry. Five of those killed are children. Israeli forces arrested around 50 Palestinians as well. Troops also conducted raids in other parts of the West Bank in the past 24 hours, including in the cities of Al-Khalil and Beit La. Tensions remain high in the occupied West Bank as Palestinians are outraged at the Israeli regime's ongoing war in the Gaza Strip. More than 80 Palestinians have lost their lives in the West Bank since the Gaza war broke out on October the 7th. Mona Kandil is joining us now from Ramallah with all the latest on the Israeli raids and crackdowns that are continuing in the occupied West Bank by the Israeli regime forces. Mona?
Well, following a 30-hour offensive in the refugee camp of Nur Shams in Tul Kerem, Israeli forces withdrew from this refugee camp, leaving 13 Palestinians had been killed by the Israeli soldiers, including at least five Palestinian minors, dozens had been wounded, and 10 Palestinians were detained by the Israeli forces from the refugee camp of Nur Shams. The operation started early on Thursday when Israeli troops said their drones had operated as well in the Nur Shams refugee camp, and that drone fired rockets at a group of Palestinians. They believe that those Palestinian, including Palestinian fighters who had been clashing with Israeli soldiers and opening fire at Israeli checkpoints near the city of Tul Kerem, northern the occupied West Bank. This is what the Israeli military said, and that's why they raided the refugee camp of Tul Kerem. The operation left clear destruction in the refugee camp, large-scale destruction in the areas. And unfortunately, since yesterday, the Israeli forces had imposed kind of curfew on the refugee camp, preventing people and paramedics, ambulances to transfer those who were wounded from the refugee camp to the hospitals. Palestinians who had been killed, the martyrs, had remained in one of the mosques there until the operation ended. As you have said, the operation and the detention of Palestinians were not only in the refugee camp of Nur Shams. Early on Friday, Israeli troops raided several areas across the occupied West Bank and detained up to the moment at least 77 Palestinians. The majority of those detention had taken place in the cities of Al-Khalil as well as in Beit Lahem. At least 35 Palestinians were detained only in Al-Khalil. We were saying that at least two journalists had been detained today, and this brings the number of Palestinian journalists behind bars to 27 Palestinian journalists. Palestinians who had been detained by the Israeli forces since the 7th of October also had reached 930 people were detained across the occupied West Bank, including journalists, activists, majority of them are Palestinian members of the Hamas movement, and parliamentarians as well, members of the Palestinian Legislative Council. 74 Palestinian people had been killed by the Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank, many of them while taking part in anti-Israel protests. One Palestinian woman was shot and killed while returning back to his hometown, as an Israeli checkpoint was at the entrance to her hometown, Deir Jir. They opened fire at the vehicle. They killed her, and her son was wounded. So at the same time, when the Israeli military is going on with their violence and aggression and these atrocities against the people of the Gaza Strip, the Israeli military are doing their utmost as well to prevent people from taking part in any protests and demonstrations here in the occupied West Bank, preventing Palestinians from being engaged in different forms of resistance. And that's why every day the Israeli forces raid the Palestinian cities, villages, refugee camps, and arrest dozens of people, young people, children, activists, people from all walks of life, including women, in order to silence the Palestinians. And in fear that Palestinians or Palestinian fighters might infiltrate into the occupied territories in 1948 and to prevent any future anti-Israeli operations there. That's why they are trying to suffocate the people, arrest as more as they can, and to prevent people from transporting within the occupied West Bank, traveling from central the West Bank to northern the West Bank or to southern the West Bank. Up till the day, hundreds of Israeli checkpoints are stationing at every checkpoint. Hundreds of Israeli soldiers are stationing at the military checkpoints, at the entrances to the villages and the cities, in order to make it easy for them to detain the people, mainly those activists and Palestinian fighters.
Pro-Palestinian protests are in full swing across the globe amid growing anti-Israeli sentiments over the regime's deadly war on the blockaded Gaza Strip. Protesters in the Greek port city of Thessaloniki burned Israel's flag to vent their anger at the regime's crimes. People from all walks of life, including students and workers, joined the demonstration, which ended in front of the U.S. consulate. The protesters expressed support for Palestinians in their fight to liberate their land. Elsewhere in Spain, protesters gathered in Barcelona to denounce Israel's continued bombardment of Gaza. They accused the regime of committing genocide in the besieged territory. Jordanians also held a fresh protest in solidarity with the Palestinian people in Gaza. Protests in Jordan's capital city of Amman was held near the Israeli embassy, with demonstrators denouncing the regime's deadly raids against Gaza. Turkey also gathered outside the Israeli consulate in Istanbul in a display of solidarity with the Palestinians in Gaza. They called for an end to Israel's massacre the territory. Health workers who were among the demonstrators condemned the regime's bombing of hospitals in Gaza. We're now bringing in Asher Shannon, our correspondent, who's been constantly giving us updates from the situation in Gaza, from Khan Yunis in the south of the Gaza Strip. Ashraf, walk us through what's taking place right now.
The recent developments now is the arrival of UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres to the Arish airport. That's Egypt's northern Sinai airport, to oversee I believe the delivery of aid to the Palestinians. This while the Egyptian authorities said that Rafah crossing are already clearing the rubble there. They're even clearing the rubble and fixing the road. I'm talking about the Egyptians themselves entered with their heavy equipment into the Palestinian side of the Rafah crossing and fixing the road, paving the way for the delivery of badly needed aid supplies to the Gaza Strip. This is the latest info we have about aid, whether it will reach its destination or not, as Israel has warned that the aid will only be allowed to enter Gaza after being checked by its forces. So let's wait and see what happens there. meanwhile, the Union of Christian Churches has condemned the recent attack on a Greek Orthodox church in Gaza City, also known as St. Porphyrius Church, where a lot of people were hurt, including dozens of Christian and Muslim families who were seeking refuge inside the church. And let's not also forget what happened the day prior to that, with hundreds of people being killed, including women and children, by the bombardment of the Israeli regime of the Protestant hospital in Gaza that also has a church in it. It seems that the Israeli regime is waging a war on all Muslims and Christians, at least when it comes to Palestinian Christians. Palestinian Christians, for the Israelis, are the same as Muslim, as Palestinian and Muslims, and they are sharing the same land, and they are suffering the same for hundreds of years. Meanwhile, the numbers of fatalities continue to increase as people are finding bodies of their relatives and loved ones under the rubble of building. People are using primitive tools to dig the debris and clear the rubble, because there's hardly any heavy machinery in the Gaza to do such work. And even if those the machinery is available, the authorities do not have fuel to run them. We are standing, as you know, inside Nasser Hospital. This is the biggest hospital in southern Gaza. And Nasser Hospital is located inside, Nasser Hospital is located in the southern Gaza Strip town of Khan Yunis. Khan Yunis is the biggest city in the Gaza Strip when it comes to the population and land. Now, basically, the population has doubled after the exodus of more than 1 million Palestinians of the northern parts of the Gaza Strip, running for safety, as after being warned and threatened by the Israeli regime. Seeing those images of people and seeing them with my own eyes, it reminded me of the Nakba of 1948, where we used to cover the stories about it and the rallies every year about it. What's happening here, Barya, is a second Nakba for the Palestinian people.
Thank you, Ashraf. Our correspondent, Ashraf Shannon, giving us constant updates on the situation in the Gaza Strip.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
EU's most powerful members squabble over subsidies. There are reports that Germany and France can't agree on funding for nuclear energy. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Bloomberg, France and Germany have failed to find a compromise over the amount of government funding that should be allocated to extending the life of nuclear reactors. Germany rejected the latest proposal to overhaul the European Union's power market over fears that France could use it to unfairly benefit its nuclear industry and undercut prices across the bloc. Time is running out for the two countries, the EU's largest economies, to resolve their dispute over the role of nuclear power in Europe's energy transition, or risk stalling the region's green agenda. According to RT, the dispute over how to use a state-backed two-way CFDs, or contracts for differences for nuclear risks, is stalling the region's green agenda. as the chances of a deal that would scale up renewable power rests on agreement between the two nations. So far, Germany has completely phased out nuclear energy, while France is heavily dependent on its aging atomic power plants for generating electricity. Last year, nuclear energy accounted for 63% of France's total electricity production. RT added, Paris has claimed that some EU member states are trying to diminish the role of nuclear power during the transition. Agnès Pannier-Runacher, France's energy transition minister, said, "What some are trying to do is to structurally degrade the competitiveness of nuclear power to the benefit of the renewables." France's energy minister said, as cited by Bloomberg, adding, "We can't end up with zero-sum game." Meanwhile, Germany has raised concerns that France could use the latest proposal to overhaul the bloc's power market to unfairly benefit its nuclear sector and undercut prices across the region. Robert Habeck, Germany's economy minister, said, "The result for me is very disappointing. If we can't agree on a level playing field for existing installations, then Germany can't vote for this proposal." Time is running out for the two economic powerhouses to resolve their spats over the issue, as a deadline to complete the task before next year's EU parliamentary elections is rapidly approaching. Meanwhile, Politico reported France and Germany remain at odds over the EU's plan to overhaul rules on government spending, making a bloc-wide deal by the end of the year still look some way off. Sparks flew between EU finance ministers when they discussed the matter in Luxembourg recently. The meeting ended without any sign of breaking the stalemate. The European Commission has made a priority of reforming the Stability and Growth Pact, designed to ensure governments don't accumulate too much debt or maintain too high a deficit. Reaching an agreement between the EU's 27 countries is urgent because the rules will be reapplied from the next year after being suspended at the onset of the COVID pandemic. While there is agreement on the broad outline of the reform and on the need to conclude it before the Commission's mandate ends next year, the exact nature of the overhaul remains in dispute, with Paris and Berlin at opposite ends of the agreement. At the behind-closed-doors meeting, finance ministers vented their frustration. Germany's Christian Lindner expressed dissatisfaction with the fact his demands were not reflected in the Spanish presidency's proposed compromise text when Italian requests were taken on board. Spanish finance minister Nadia Calviño, who was chairing the meeting, replied with laughter, according to two EU diplomats briefed on the talks. Politico added, the Stability and Growth Pact is aimed at keeping government debt at or reducing it to 60% of GDP and maintaining annual deficits within 3% of GDP. Germany wants a safeguard, a minimum speed of debt reduction, and a benchmark to keep deficits below that level. A number of countries, including Austria, Finland, Czech Republic, Lithuania, Latvia, the Netherlands, Portugal, Sweden and Slovakia, also raised the need to ensure debt sustainability. German Finance Minister Christian Lindner told reporters before the meeting, "It is not credible to see lower debt levels without sustainable annual deficits. We have a reference of 3% of GDP, but this is not the target. This is the limit." He wants a safety margin for countries to keep deficits in check. The main point of this agreement is how quickly excess debt should be slashed by countries above the 60% debt-to-GDP threshold and how much deficit should be constrained. France is resisting a focus on reducing annual spending French Finance Minister Bruno Le Maire told reporters before the meeting, "It's absolutely key to focus on one single element on which we could try to find a compromise. My proposal is to really focus on the question of debt sustainability."
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Crisis is a term that is associated with Europe these days more than other parts of the world. The country that is in the lead in Europe is the UK. A series of labor strikes and industrial disputes have occurred in various industries of the UK's economy as workers have walked out over pay and conditions, the most recent one being junior doctors and consultants. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at why so many workers in so many different sectors of the UK are striking and whether the Sunak government has been able to handle the issue properly. First, let me introduce our guest for this program. Keith Philbin, Professor of International Economics and Finance at City University, joins us from London. Tony Gosling, historian and investigative journalist, joins us from Bristol. Welcome to you both. Keith Philbin, I'll start with you. What are your thoughts on this strike by doctors and consultants? It's a three-day walkout, but it is said that it's going to affect obviously the care that patients are going to need, and that's another whole question that I'm going to ask on that regard. But do they stand a chance? It sounds like the government has to come to the negotiating table, but are they going to do that?
Well, the government, let's be honest, is out of money. They wasted so much money during the COVID pandemic, etc. Yeah, PPE equipment. They don't have much money left. We still got a massive fiscal deficit in this country, all right? And therefore, there really isn't the money to make big pay rises in the public sector. So at the end of the day, the government must also realise that these strikes are extremely costly because they're leading to people not getting their medical care on time. That means they're off work, not paying taxes, etc. So at the end of the day, there has to be some sort of compromise. It's going to be nowhere near the 35% catch-up the doctors would like. That's never going to happen. Because it would just spark off further pressures in the public sector. But an inflation matching pay rise is certainly something the government can afford. And we've got to remember that a lot of these people, you know, particularly consultants, they're getting taxed at 62% for quite a bit of their income, between £100,000 and £125,000.
I'm sorry,
there's
how much did you say?
62%.
62%.
62%. Yeah, because they lose their tax-free allowance, which is also taxed at 40%. So if you earn an extra £25,000, between £100,000 and £125,000, which a lot of consultants are in, £15,500 goes to the government and £9,500 goes to them. So not many people know about this, but this is clearly another thing that is, you know, really... I mean, the government wants to cut taxes for the wealthy, but won't cut it for the middle classes, who are being taxed outrageously at 62% for a certain amount of their income. It goes down afterwards, after 125,000, it drops down to 47%, which is still pretty high, but it's 62%. And that actually gets a lot of doctors, you see. So Liz Truss, when she did these tax cuts for the very wealthy, okay, above 160,000, which, you know, that seems rather stupid when she could have actually done something for these doctors that are between the 100 to 125,000, all right? So that's stupidity of the first order. And it's a stupid tax anyway. It's actually holding the economy back because lots of doctors stop working when they've got £99,900, okay? No one wants to be taxed at 62%. I'm not making these figures up. They're facts. You can go to the HMRC website and check them out. So
I'm sorry to jump in, but I just checked out what you said in terms of taxes, and I put an average worker, and I'm shocked to find out that it says the UK's take-home pay of an average single worker after tax and benefits was 76.4% of their gross wage, compared to the OECD average of 75.4%.
Yeah.
How does that? This changes the whole tone of the program. How do you figure the government? What comes to mind is if they're taking that much taxes away, it must leave the government more room to negotiate. But then they probably are banking on these taxes in terms of revenues that they're spending in other places, I'm guessing.
Well, you see, you also, when you earn your money, they take off income, national insurance off you and everything like that. But then, of course, they're taking VAT when you earn your spending money. So you're paying even more when you fill up your car with petrol. Right. You know, you put £100 in, £75 is probably off to the government.
Let me bring it.
So it's shocking rates of taxation we're facing. And basically, the government can't raise taxes anymore. That's clear.
Right. Let's bring in Tony Gosling in here.
Good on the wealthy.
Let's bring in Tony Gosling in here. Tony Gosling, I'm sorry to take so long to get to you, but this is just shocking stats on the tax issue where, aside from the government, putting that aside, how do people survive if that much taxes are taking out? Because that's something that was overlooked and not really spoken much about when it comes to the workers and the pay they're getting in terms of how much taxes that's being taken out.
It's built into the system. As there is inflation, as is now running food inflation nearly 20%, it's just coming down a little bit, but that's where it's been. So everybody is moved up into the higher tax brackets. And what they've been doing is they've not been moving the tax brackets. So people at the moment, on average wages, are being taxed like maybe a decade ago the super rich were. So these rates of tax, and it's the same with housing, exactly the same with housing. So, you know, say, for example, the inheritance tax thresholds haven't been raised, even though the price of housing is going up. So as the economy starts to fall apart, more and more middle earners and low wage earners are moving up into the high tax rates. And actually what's happening is work is no longer a way out of poverty. So people are starting to work and then finding that they're actually ending up with less money than they've had on benefits, and they just simply cannot pay the rent and they're being evicted from their homes, this sort of thing. So you're right. Welcome to basket case Britain, because the economy is in an absolutely terrible state. In a way, it's a kind of hybrid war, the same hybrid war that's being waged on Ukraine. And of course, if you think about it, but it's being waged on the British people as well. And if you think about the amounts of billions that have been spent on Ukraine, it's quite obvious the government does have the money to pay the doctors. They have a choice to make. Do they want that money to go to arms and to arming this proxy war we're doing for the Americans over in far distant Eastern Europe? Or do they want to pay doctors properly? And the fact of the strikes, I'm absolutely 100% with the doctors, because the doctors know that what's happening is the senior staff in the health service, particularly the professionals that are making the life and death decisions, the consultants, the doctors, the registrars, are moving abroad because the pay is too low here. They cannot afford to pay the rent, to pay the mortgage on those wages. And so they're going off to get much better wages abroad. And so they are the ones who are trying to save the health service by flagging up to the nation that they need to be paid proper wages in order to keep the NHS alive. And of course, if you think about the government we've got at the moment, the Conservatives have always wanted to destroy the National Health Service, this free health service for everyone in the country. The Conservatives don't like that. They want to go over to a American-style health insurance system. And actually, the American health companies are all, they've got very busy London offices because they are lobbying for this change too. So they're trying to destroy the National Health Service, and they're doing that by making sure the doctors just flee the country and go abroad.
Well, let's move on beyond just the health service and take a look at other sectors of the UK economy if we can, because this thing about taxes has thrown me off. But Keith Pilbeam, nevertheless, I'd like to ask you about one of the things that are in the basket of expenses of an average person there in the UK and across the world, really, in a matter of speaking, and that's the cost of food. We know food prices have risen, but by how much have they risen? I'm trying to get an idea based on going through the inflation, which puts it at around 7 or 8%. But I think it's a lot more than that, because when you look at categories of food, or just food itself, whether it's margarine or eggs or other items, you can see that it's a lot more than that. It depends what you're looking at. It doesn't really come out to the 7 or 8% they're talking about. What's the story there?
Well, food inflation is much higher than 7 or 8%. It is actually around 17%. Of course, it depends. For different people, it'd be higher or lower, depending what food they eat. But food inflation has been running particularly high, which impacts the poorest people. You see, the headline rate of inflation, 6.8 now, but don't forget it was 10.9. That doesn't mean everything went up by 10.9 or 6.8%, all right? Some things go up far more. And of course, poor people spend proportionately more of their money on food. So the inflation rate facing poor people is substantially higher than the headline figure. Everybody knows that, the government knows that, and no one can deny it. So that is causing poor people problems because, you know, they spend more of their money on food and rent, of course, which has also been skyrocketing. So the Bank of England, I believe, is trying to do some analysis of this. But, you know, if you're in the lower 20%
right.
of British income, you're getting, you know, inflation plus tax rises and council tax going through the roof. It's miserable.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, Tony Gosling, when I read this headline, I felt a sigh of relief for the people there in the UK, where The Guardian, I'm going to say the name, ran and said UK food prices fall in September for the first time in 2 years. But then you read the print below that, taking a closer look, it dropped by 0.1%. If we're looking at 19.4% or 19.1%, and they cited that as being food inflation for 2022. That's not much of a price drop, if you ask me. I mean, it doesn't sound like a lot at all compared to rate of food inflation.
What's
the impact that it has had on poverty there in the UK?
Let me just explain. It's not really a price drop at all. What's been happening is these German-owned supermarkets, Lidl and Aldi, have been opening across the country. They've been doing very well and opening new stores over the last couple of years. And so what we're seeing is more and more people leaving the mainstream British supermarkets and going to these German cheapo supermarkets. And so therefore, that's the only thing that's really been bringing. The fact of the matter is that these massive food cartels have been price fixing. They know they've got a pretty much a stranglehold on the market, that the small grocer shops dotted around the country, there's not many left, are really not able to compete with these massive supermarkets anymore. And so they do deals with the supermarkets as a cartel, and they've been slowly putting up the prices. In fact, there have been one or two supermarkets, such as Sainsbury's here in Britain, who have actually refused to stock products like Heinz products, for example, because these massive food conglomerates have been price fixing, and they're saying, well, this is far too much. We want to sell someone else's baked beans or whatever, and we're not going to sell yours because your price is way too high. Your margins are high. And of course, this is just being done to the benefit of shareholders, because they now have such a stranglehold on the food market that they can start to jack up prices anywhere they want. And I mean, this is, of course, as Keith says, it's affecting the poor far more. And that's the perversity of all of this, is that you've now got the rich paying virtually no tax. These are the people, by the way, if we wanted to raise tax, we've got lots of super rich people that we could be taking this money off from their investments. You know, say, for example, you've got hundreds of millions of pounds invested. Well, if you were to lose half of that, you wouldn't even notice a single difference in your lifestyle. And so that we should be morally doing. We should be grabbing that money, even if it is offshore, or if as soon sure. as we should, you know, we need to take the money off the rich. And what's happening is with this food price inflation is the poor are being hit and the rich are being left scot-free. So it's almost certain. I mean, we've had the big speech today by British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak at the Conservative Party conference. They've got a general election next year, so it's probably his last chance to sell the Conservative vote to the voters. And he's come up with absolutely nothing, nothing at all. And he's talking about change, but we know that he's not changing anything. So it seems to me, and in fact I've heard this from insiders, okay. that there are many people at the top of the Conservative Party here that don't want to win the next general election. So they're not interested in dealing with these issues. They're only interested in looking at their apps on their phones to see how much dividends on their big share investments Indeed. That they're getting. That's their interest. The public and the voters are nowhere in the equation.
We're going to talk about it a little bit more, but I'd like to ask you an economic question here, Keith Pilbeam, because it seems like it's a contradiction, but yet it works out for the benefit of the economy somehow, which is why I want to ask you. And that's the deal with interest rates. All right, we know that there's interest rates that have been risen on a number of occasions by the central bank, and that is the way to tame inflation, for lack of a better word. But when you know when you raise the interest rates, it's got its pluses and minuses. Can you please explain to us how that works out? Because we know that there are obviously setbacks based on the impact it has on the different sectors of the economy.
Well, interest rates, of course, they've gone up. But what one must remember is that they were manipulated by the Bank of England to record levels for numerous years, barely below 1%. All right. So even on 10 years, the government could borrow, listen, at 0.6% with inflation target of 2%. That made no economic sense whatsoever, by the way. That's, you know, and all these people that invested in those bonds, including pension funds, by the way, that was stupidity of the highest order. I mean, no one should be lending to governments at 0.6% with an inflation target of 2%. All right. So now they can't print any more money. They've printed so much that it's actually one of the big causes of inflation. They won't admit it. Andrew Failey, I insist on calling him Failey, not Bailey. You know, he printed so much money, it's just incredible. 300 billion in 1 year to pay for all this COVID and fiscal deficits. So eventually, you see, that's going to come home to roost. And interest rates are bound to go up when inflation goes up. And now inflation is up and not really under control because people are still trying to catch up because they lost out last year on their wage rises, you know, less than inflation. So they're trying to catch up this year. It's not going to go down quickly. The Bank of England was, as usual, asleep at the wheel. They said inflation would go to 4.5, you know, well outside their target, by the way. Then it went to 6, then they were forecasting 8, then they forecasted 10. I mean, the Bank of England should be closed as an institution, you know, with its forecasting record, and the governor sacked. So we've got to get used to much higher interest rates, all right? Because we've now got record levels of debt. The government has borrowed so much money that the national debt has gone from, you know, to over 100% of GDP. Companies have borrowed too much, all right? When interest rates were low, what do? They borrow. And of course, people borrow to buy houses at absurd prices. And when interest rates go up, it's bound to hit the property sector
Sure.
and many other sectors. Zombie companies, they've been kept alive through low interest rates, okay? But now interest rates are going up, those zombie companies have to liquidate, go bankrupt, and we're seeing that increasingly, bankruptcies everywhere. And it was all because of the incompetence of the Bank of England. They should not be celebrating getting inflation down to 6.8 or 5. It is ridiculously high. It is still well above the maximum of 3%. It's 2% plus or minus 1%.
Okay.
So this is not any success. This is failure. You can't celebrate failure of that degree and Sure. say you're doing something.
All right. Tony Gosling, you talked about Sunak. One of the things that has come out, and I'd like to ask from you, whether it's a reflection of the types of decisions that go against maybe improving the economy, and that was the cancellation, from what we understand, of the scrapping of the HS2. Which was said that it would have cut journey times, would have created more space on the rail network, and also would boost jobs outside of London. What are your thoughts, first of all, on his decision on doing that? And tell us some of the flops that he has actually is guilty of when it comes to the economy, the decisions that maybe that he made that has impacted the economy negatively.
Well, look, these massive infrastructure projects like HS2 should never have been signed off in the first place. That money could far better have been spent on upgrading existing railways, opening maybe some of the railways which were shut in the 1960s, and that sort of thing would have been extremely good for the environment. But no, most of the pressure to sign those contracts to build this railway were there from the construction companies, because they've made an absolute fortune on this railway to nowhere. It is just from London to Birmingham, which is, there is an existing fairly good service there anyway, which they could have used maybe one-tenth of this money to upgrade that service. The whole thing is, I think, a contract fraud that was signed by the end of the last Labour government in 2009. And then the Conservatives, if they had had a proper look at the books, should have just scrapped it as soon as they came into office in 2010. But they don't like that. It's embarrassing. And there may be costs. They actually had Jacob Rees-Mogg quite bravely said that the whole thing should have been scrapped 5 years ago. He said that. So, this is a disaster. It's good that it's gone. The other thing is, the other infrastructure project near me in Bristol is this Hinkley C nuclear power station. Again, there's no real guarantees this is going to deliver affordable electricity ever. And yet billions are being spent on these projects. I think it's just really about the construction contracts. Those companies are going to definitely get lots and lots of money, but there may be nothing at the end of it to deliver. So this is, I think, a massive fraud. Enormous mistakes he's made, Sunak. And, of course, the chances are he's never going to make it to win an election next year. No chance. It's most probably going to be a hung parliament. This has not been an economic crisis for everybody. The super rich 0.1% have done incredibly well out of this Conservative government. And they have actually seen their billions multiply. And those are the people who are calling the shots. And that's why it's almost impossible that Sunak, because he came out with something today about smoking, for example, which you think, well, this is not going to win you the election, mate. No chance. And so he's got nothing to offer, really, except empty words. And so we're probably going to see a Labour government next year, and the Conservatives are going to applaud their leader as he just drags them down into a black hole, never to be seen again.
All right, I got one last question over here. I was going to talk about how the rich got richer, but that almost sounds like a cliche. So, Keith Pilby, my last question is about manufacturing in the UK, where it is said that there's been a, not it is said, it's been on the decline, to the point where many headlines read why the government has actually abandoned the manufacturing sector. Is it that bad? Has manufacturing declined to the point that the UK doesn't really make anything anymore? In a minute, if you can, please.
Well, we've still got the manufacturing base, but it's been decimated by Brexit. And you see that in the car industry. You know, output is now half what it was in 2016. No one wants to invest here. You get the odd thing that comes up because the government's subsidising it. Yep. Second the subsidies run out, they'll be either asking for more money or closing these factories. So it's been in decline for many years. This government doesn't care about manufacturing. We do have some good manufacturers, by the way. But the death knell has been paperwork, bureaucracy and Brexit. Their closest market is, of course, now very difficult for them, especially small manufacturers. You know, they used to use the EU to grow a bit bigger. Now they don't grow bigger. They stay in the UK. And also, they can't get the parts so easily from Europe because they don't want to supply them because of the paperwork again. So it's all self-inflicted. It's, you know, the whole country's gone to pot, really. And it's incompetence of the government. It's not just Brexit. It is the most incompetent government we've probably ever had in the last 10 years. I can't think of any government over the last 10 years, including, you know, that includes Boris, of course. But this shambles is just 13 years of disaster.
Yeah, okay, but 30 seconds, yeah, but, 30 seconds, Tony Gosson.
Okay, well, look, the trouble is that Britain lost control of its industrial policy not because of Brexit, but when they entered the EEC back in the 1970s. Britain has never had, Britain's governments have never had control of their economic policy. At least we still got the pound, which gives us a little bit of leeway. And ultimately, I'm afraid Britain is not going to be, and it's not just Britain, it's the whole of Europe. Germany Indeed. Is now okay. slumping sure. its manufacturing base, so Britain Thank can you. Shake hands with the Germans and say we're going to go down together.
Thank you. Sorry to interrupt you. Tony Gosling, their historian and investigative journalist, and thank you, Keith Pilbeam, professor of international economics and finance at City University. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this thank edition you. Of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tawe and the team, it's goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Al-Naqi means the pure, the immaculate, the clean. Al-Hadi means the guide. All the Imams came for guidance.
As-salamu alaykum ya ahla bayt al-nubuwa wa mawdaa al-risala wa mukhtalaf al-malaa.
Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety.
This is Dialogue, an introduction into the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam. Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam was the pure and noble direct descendant of the Messenger of Allah, the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. He was the 10th divinely appointed Imam, he was the 10th divinely appointed successor, and he was the 10th divinely appointed trustee to the final seal of prophethood, the Messenger of Allah, the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. He was the son of the 9th divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam had complete mastery over the Islamic sciences and even the non-Islamic sciences. All people came and benefited from Imam al-Hadi's vast treasures of knowledge and wisdom. Whether it was the sciences that dealt with the Qur'an, or the seerah and the sunnah of the infallibles, or whether it was the sciences of philosophy, theology, jurisprudence, anything that was posed to Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam as a question was answered by his eminence. And all this despite his tender age, for he was quite young when Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam attained the position of Imama, gifted and endowed to him by the Almighty Allah.
Parts of Ziyara text of Jamaatul Kabira, issued by Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As-salamu ala a'immatil huda wa masabih al-tuja wa a'lam al-tuqa wa dawilluha.
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety, the owners of understanding, the endued with thought, the havens of the peoples, the inheritors of the prophets, the perfect specimen, the most excellent call in the arguments of Allah against the inhabitants of the world, the hereafter and the former world. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon you all.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. As-salamu ala mahal ma'rifah.
Peace be upon the exponents of the recognition of Allah, the centers of Allah's blessing, the essence of Allah's wisdom, the keepers of Allah's secrets, the bearers of Allah's book, the successor of Allah's Prophet, and the progeny of Allah's Messenger. May Allah send blessings upon him and his household. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon them.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. As-salamu ala ad-du'ati ila Allah wal-adillahi ala marzatillah.
Peace be upon the callers of Allah, the leaders to Allah's pleasure, the abiders of Allah's decree, the perfect in love for Allah, the sincere in professing Allah's oneness, the manifester of Allah's orders and prohibitions, and Allah's honored bondmen who speak not until He has spoken and act by His command. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon them.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, the 10th divinely appointed Imam from the household and the Ahlul Bayt of the Messenger of Allah, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. So, we're talking about these dialogues. There's this one instance where a companion of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam came to His Eminence, and in his presence, he asked him a question. He asked him, what is the status of Imam Ali alayhi salam? Now, before we give the answer that Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam gave in this conversation and in this dialogue, It's important to note that in the era of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, of course, which was the governmental establishment of the Abbasid Khulafa, it was the Abbasid monarchy, the Abbasid dynasty, Imam Ali alayhi salam was not given his due status, meaning the divine wilaya and the divine imama and this position of supremacy that Imam Ali alayhi salam had, he was not given that due right from the pulpits and from the speaking outlets of the Abbasid dynasty. And so here we find that these kind of questions were not something that were out of the ordinary. People still wanted to know what the status of